Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Sometimes the news isn't what did happen, but what didn't. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson didn't hold a Sunday afternoon press conference this weekend. Despite wild speculation last week, he did not announce he's plowing billions of taxpayer dollars into Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And the world didn't end. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday today, the 25th of August. Good to have you here. Even if you weren't paying real close attention last week, you probably noticed something was amiss with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Shares for the government-sponsored mortgage companies were going nowhere but down. There was respectable speculation that some sort of federal intervention was likely. And then, all of a sudden, it was this morning. And nothing. No panic, no takeover, and no problem for Freddie Mac as it tried to sell off $2 billion worth of short-term debt this morning. That suggests Fannie and Freddie just might be able to keep on going without help from the Treasury Department. But our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports the pair aren't out of the woods just yet.
Most investors are betting the housing slump will leave Fannie and Freddie insolvent without some sort of emergency support from the government.
I think we're talking about a monumental problem.
Marilyn Cohen, the president of Envision Capital Management, says the government has to help Fannie and Freddie because shareholders include major cogs in the economy's machinery. Pension funds and small banks rely on Fannie and Freddie dividends for capital that they couldn't raise anywhere else, especially given the current credit crunch. Small banks might be pushed into bankruptcy, not to mention international central banks that hold Fannie and Freddie's preferred shares.
Considering that we rely not only on the kindness of foreigners and foreign central banks to help prop up our huge deficits, we are really relying on their need for safety, and I think the thought of them not making their payments is pretty unthinkable.
Essentially, you're looking at a Treasury bailout to save the world's financial system.
Well, I don't think that's too overdramatic, yes.
Not helping Fannie and Freddie could also mean higher-priced mortgages. Still, Peter Wallison of the American Enterprise Institute thinks the government should do nothing.
To see whether they can survive by raising their own capital or because the real estate market has stabilized. And if it does not happen, then the government should put them into receivership.
In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
John alluded to the fact that there are a lot of foreign investors in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Russia is one of them, one of the big ones, too. The central bank holds about $40 billion in Fannie and Freddie debt. You might think investments like that would lead Moscow to closer economic ties with the West, but as we know, the last couple of weeks have forced everybody to rethink what the Russians might do. Today, Prime Minister Vladimir Putin added to the economic uncertainty when he said some not-so-nice things about the World Trade Organization. Russia won't benefit from joining the WTO, he said, and in fact might back away from some of the promises it's made during a decade and a half of membership negotiations. From the Marketplace European Desk in London, Stephen Beard reports.
Russia is by far the largest country outside the WTO. Moscow has been seeking membership for more than a decade. Today's remarks by Putin paralyzed that process. But Nick Redman of the Economist Intelligence Unit says Putin was just getting his retaliation in first. Russian membership was going to be blocked anyway.
The Georgians quite clearly aren't going to wave them in anytime soon. The Americans are looking much the same. So you've got to put a brave face on it.
Nevertheless, many observers see Putin's remarks as a real setback for the global economy. Quentin Peel, international affairs editor of the Financial Times, says the West has much to gain from Russia joining the WTO.
What the West would get out of it would be Russia obeying more rules of the economic game, having to be transparent in its pricing policies, getting rid of heavy energy subsidies, having a really competitive financial sector.
And he says Russia would benefit from WTO membership as well, although Putin and his government don't seem to realise it.
It would be fantastically good for Russia too. It's a much more inefficient Russian economy that is outside the WTO.
He does not forecast a new Cold War or a new Ice Age in Russia's economic relations with the West. The fundamentals haven't changed. We still need Russian energy. They still need Western markets. But he says trust is fast corroding. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Last year, the federal government told us that a little more than 12% of all Americans were officially impoverished. More than 36 million people were living at or below the poverty line. Tomorrow, the Census Bureau is going to update that number for 2007. And with the economy slowing, there's a chance the number's bumped up a bit. We think of government figures like this one as being pretty precise. But Marketplace's Steve Henn explains there's actually a big debate about what the federal poverty line really means.
In 1969, a Census Bureau economist defined poverty as the minimum a family could spend on a balanced diet for a year and multiplied that by three. If you earn less, you were poor. 40 years later, food makes up just 1/7 of the average family budget, but the poverty threshold in the United States is still calculated pretty much the same way.
The numbers that we're using no longer reflect reality.
Michael Loresi is at the Annie E. Casey Foundation. He says childcare, housing, and transportation are all essentials for working families, but the costs of these things don't figure in the poverty rate.
You know, we're constantly misjudging who's poor because the number's so out of date.
The federal poverty threshold also doesn't count food stamps or other aid programs as income. Ron Haskins at the Brookings Institution says fighting poverty that way is like groping through a cluttered room in the dark.
So when we make food stamps more generous, as we did in 2002, it has no effect on the poverty rate because these things are ignored in calculating poverty.
Earlier this year, New York created its own poverty line. Here's Deputy Mayor for Health and Human Services Linda Gibbs.
We wanted a measure that would tell us whether or not what we were doing actually worked or not.
New York's poverty threshold counts aid programs and housing. When the city recalculated its poverty line, the rate ticked up slightly, fell for families with kids, but poverty among seniors increased. Gibbs says these results are already affecting policy debates. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
There wasn't much debate on Wall Street today. Lousy is the word you're looking for here. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Democrats have gathered in Denver. They will be partying and schmoozing and, yeah, probably talking policy for the rest of the week. While the convention's in session, we've asked some prominent Democratic policy types to complain. That is, tell us where they think the party has gone astray on some of their key issues. Today, commentator and education reformer Steve Barr says Democrats are behind the curve on education.
Check out any national poll on issues important to Americans, and they'll tell you the same thing. On education, voters trust Democrats more than they do Republicans, and it's been that way for decades. But my fellow Democrats haven't done much in recent years to earn that trust. Party leaders aren't addressing education in a real way. And when they do, it's usually to condemn No Child Left Behind or make a vague appeal for better schools. Rarely do Democratic Party leaders offer a clear vision for what a 21st century education should look like. Now, the Dems don't have it easy. There are two warring tribes within their ranks, teachers' unions and school reform advocates who are wary of teachers' unions. So let me offer a new progressive vision to my beloved party so it can challenge these tribes to come together. Community-based, decentralized school districts composed of small schools. Study after study shows that a smaller school gives a kid the best chance to succeed. A decentralized district would streamline money to school sites, where each school would control its own budget. School leaders, including teachers, would make the hires. But the key is high expectations. All stakeholders must believe that every kid can learn and can be college and workforce ready. Autonomy is maintained based on student performance. and if the school fails to meet expectations, that local control can be taken away. This model offers teachers better work conditions, more generous pay, and a say on what goes on in front of them. In exchange, the school asks for accountability, because contrary to perception, people want to teach, they just don't want a sucker's bet. This all seems like common sense, so what's the problem? Unfortunately, there's a great deal of institutional resistance built into the system. Too many urban school districts have deteriorated into instruments of patronage, and teacher contracts are written in reaction to centralized, outmoded systems. With a new progressive vision, there'll be a need for a new unionism. And wouldn't we all love to see every cent of our tax dollars go directly to a small public school in our neighborhood with the best-paid union teachers who believe in our children as much as we all do?
Steve Barr is the founder of Green Dot Public Schools. That's one of the leading charter schools operators here in Los Angeles. He's also a former finance chair for the Democratic Party. Next week, it's the Republicans' turn in the spotlight, and we will be taking a look at their issues then. Send us your thoughts. Marketplace.org is the website. Click on the link that says Contact. Denver's not a town that normally gets a whole lot of media attention, and there's a logical reason for that. It's pretty far away from some of the bigger economic and political centers of power in this country. But Denver is trying to break into that tier, and as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports, some in the city think they can show us the shape of our economic future.
This is the terminal. All passengers, please exit.
Many Americans don't know much about Denver beyond the airport. It's the world's 11th busiest, and it's critical to Denver's economy. But it's no longer the talk of the town, the way it was when it opened 13 years ago.
Well, today we have a very diverse economy.
That's former Denver Mayor Federico Pena, who now works at a private equity firm high above Denver's version of Wall Street.
And because our economy is so diverse, whenever one sector is down, let's say the internet sector or perhaps the oil and gas sector, there are other sectors that are doing well.
That diversity could really pay dividends for cities like Detroit that are tied to the booms and busts of one big industry. So what's booming enough to counteract national busts in aviation, telecom, tourism, financial services, and the housing sector? I asked Rich Wobbekin, Associate Dean at the University of Colorado Boulder's Business School. Where's the growth? What's the future?
Well, certainly currently the energy industry broadly has been a major driving force for the state economy.
And not just because of Colorado's luck in having some of the largest oil and natural gas reserves in the nation. A big part of the state's energy future is renewable.
Take a left here.
And ground zero for the nation's alternative energy research is about 12 miles west of Denver.
We are just on the edge of the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, and we are driving right now into the NREL, or National Renewable Energy Laboratory campus. You can see on the right the wind turbines.
Tom Clark of the Metro Denver Economic Development Corporation drove me to the region's economic hotspots. He says the federal lab here has already attracted ConocoPhillips. The energy giant is opening a 7,000-person campus nearby.
A federal lab is really important. It takes kind of the upfront basic science risk, and then as they develop that technology, private investment comes in.
It's a model Denver is using on the other side of town as well, where hospitals and drug companies now occupy an old military base that's been transformed into a leading bioscience park.
This allows inventions coming out of the research labs to go literally across the street to be taken into the open marketplace.
Denver's strategic planning is helped by something not a lot of cities have, space. The downside of that is you've got to drive long distances to get from here to there. And that brings up another aspect of the mile-high city that other big, sprawling Western metropolises might soon copy. Colorado taxpayers actually voted to pay a higher sales tax to build a light rail system that will span the region. It's a point of pride, as you can hear from this song Tom Clark wrote when part of the system, called T-Rex, was completed.
Hooray, T-Rex, you're finally finished. How'd we ever build something so big? On budget and ahead of the schedule, let's tell the folks that Boston's big dig.
If Denver's economy is the futuristic success story Tom Clark would have you believe, it's because of two things. A highly educated workforce, due mostly to outsiders coming to work in the high-tech industries that dot Denver's landscape, and, says former Mayor Federico Pena, a regional mentality. Dozens of cities across hundreds of miles all consider themselves part of the same community.
We probably have more metropolitan-wide districts of one kind or another than any other part of the United States.
For instance, unlike, say, New York, there's one regional transit authority spanning numerous municipalities and governed by one body. There's similar regional cooperation in everything from sewage to the arts. And of course, it helps that the whole region falls within the borders of just one state. But there's another big reason to work together, says Steve McMillan, business editor of the Denver Post.
There are no major cities for hundreds and hundreds of miles. Right here along the Front Range, we are an economy unto ourselves. Denver stands alone.
Perhaps the most futuristic things about Colorado are its problems. There's not a lot of water around here, and ever more consumers thanks to a rapidly growing population. And there's a real worry about the state's crumbling education system. Colorado's libertarian streak led to the passage of a law that makes raising money for local education difficult. And everyone I spoke with, including Colorado's biggest cheerleaders, said if the state doesn't start educating its own children and growing its own talent pool, its economy will suffer. That warning is one thing about this region that's far from unique. In Denver, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Coming up, fear of the office green police.
If she saw you throw away a plastic fork, she would take that fork out of the trash and come after you with it, and then she'd rinse it off and recycle it.
But first, let's do the numbers. Volume was light, but the carnage was heavy today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials tumbled 2%, 241 points to close at 11,386. The NASDAQ plunged 2%, 49 points to finish at 2365. The S&P 500 couldn't quite make it, dropped 1.9%, not 2.0, 25 points to end the day at 1266. American International Group stumbled 5.5% today to a 13-year low. Credit Suisse said it expects share prices to fall for the nation's largest insurer. We told you about Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. They bucked market trends today. Freddie jumped 17%. Fannie Mae spiked up almost 4%. Financials took a pounding, though. Rumblings about Lehman Brothers' future sent its stock down 6.75% today. Investors took refuge in bonds instead. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell sharply to 3.78%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for July. The Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. And on August 26, 1939, the Cincinnati Reds played the Brooklyn Dodgers in the first televised broadcast of a Major League Baseball game. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Banana growers in the Caribbean must be wondering if they can catch a break, for crying out loud. Last week, their regional cooperative announced exports have finally bounced back from the damage done by Hurricane Dean a year ago. But then today, the National Weather Service announced Tropical Storm Gustav has formed and is bearing down on Haiti and the Dominican Republic. Trouble's nothing new to banana growers, though. Historically, though, it's been more man-made than a force of nature. Author Peter Chapman chronicles the rise and fall of the company at the center of a lot of that trouble, the United Fruit Company, in his book, Bananas.
The key character in the story is a young guy from Brooklyn, New York, called Minor Keith, a rich lad from that part of the Northeast. Family connections were building a railway in Costa Rica. And while the railway was struggling to be built on the Atlantic coast of Costa Rica in terrible conditions, Minor Keith saw that the bananas in the jungle, he started to grow a few at the side of the railway line and realized that this could be quite a commodity and he could start shipping it back to the States. And he started to produce it in great mass on huge plantations.
And eventually this becomes the United Fruit Company, doesn't it?
It does.
And it was, I think you say it at one point in your book, it was remarkably operationally efficient in getting done what it wanted to do.
Operationally efficient, economically efficient, by growing the banana on these huge plantations, it was able to bring the price down. It was able to produce in such mass. So it turned what was a luxury into this commodity that was available to all. It was very efficient like that, and it could also be operationally efficient on the political side of things. It usually required governments in its areas of operation to comply with its conditions, how it wanted to operate, and it wasn't above changing those governments if it didn't like what they were doing.
Some would say efficient. Others might say ruthless in getting done what it wanted to get done.
Efficient and ruthless. The coup d'etat in Guatemala in 1954, an elected government came in Guatemala. It decided that there was a need for land for landless farmers, landless peasants. And the United Fruit Company had an awful lot of unused land. The government said it was going to take some away. It was going to give some compensation in the form of bonds. And the fruit company was able, with its influence in Washington, to remove this government.
Help me understand something, though. How was it that the United Fruit Company turned its massive land holdings and political connections into the power to tell these Central American republics what to do?
Well, the thing is, of course, it became stronger in an economic sense than many of these governments. And the United Fruit Company would have control, shall we say, over the railway system. It would also control the shipping in and out of the country. So it had strategic control of very important areas of infrastructure in the economy, and in that way could dictate or at least greatly manipulate the forces of politics in those small countries of Central America.
What's the legacy on the ground in Central America today of this company and the way it did business?
Well, you can't blame every bit of corruption in Central America, of course, onto the United Fruit Company. There was a fair bit there when they arrived. They took advantage of a situation and they probably exacerbated it. In terms of the problems of trying to get democracy with any kind of root in Central America, the United Fruit Company did no good at all. The banana is a very dubious crop indeed. We all, to some extent, depend on it as we have our cereal in the morning. But it's a highly vulnerable crop and at the moment is suffering from diseases which might soon, within the next decade or so, wipe it out. So it's a fair degree of, or an unfair degree, if you like, a legacy of political and economic instability and dependency upon a commodity which really doesn't seem to have as great a future as we might hope.
The book about the United Fruit Company by Peter Chapman is called Bananas. Mr. Chapman, thanks so much.
Thank you, Kai.
Office politics usually breaks down along traditional lines, red for Republicans, blue for Democrats. But even though we're smack in the middle of election season, there's a new color to consider around the water cooler. Green, really, really green, too. While studies do show that most workers want their firms to do more for the environment, some individual employees are going above and beyond the call of the carbon footprint. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Beth Tytel reports.
Rita Dalton is an executive assistant at the Charles Hotel in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She's also her department's green cop, policing the company's recycling program. Every day, she goes through the contents of the blue plastic bins in the back office. Her colleagues at the hotel are supposed to separate paper from plastic, but Dalton regularly finds violations. Salad containers filled with lettuce and feta cheese, used tissues, staples.
There is gum, I was right. Peppermint, maybe? I don't know.
Maybe you should do a breath test around here. Dalton started off using inspirational quotes, urging coworkers to, quote, be the change you want to see in the world. But when that failed, she switched tactics.
So I generally just make comments about how stupid people are and make sure I do it loud enough so that everyone in the office can hear it.
Office workers Brace yourselves. The enviromaniacs are on the loose. They're rummaging through co-workers' trash, haranguing colleagues who don't take public transit, turning off bathroom lights before the stalls are empty. In some offices, only the brave dare to take a styrofoam cup from the cafeteria or print out an email. It's no wonder that veteran human resources consultant Nancy Nelson sees the environment as the next workplace battleground, pitting workers who considered bottled water a civil right against those who see it as a crime against humanity.
People are becoming emotionally charged about green issues.
How charged? Well, here's what Henry Santoro, news director of WFNX in Boston, says about his office's self-appointed green cop.
She's the Osama bin Laden of green terrorists. If she saw you throw away a plastic fork, she would take that fork out of the trash and come after you with it, and then she'd rinse it off and recycle it. She can look at you and know whether or not you've been a good recycler today.
When a green monster's on the prowl, no one's safe, not even other environmentalists, says Lorelei Grazier, the organizer of a green convention in Boston.
Twice in the past 2 months, I've attended sustainable conferences, and at both conferences, during the Q&A, someone had to stand up and let us all know that we could be doing this in a more sustainable manner, that we could have a webinar. So we were all publicly shamed for being there.
To be fair, many green enforcers mean well, but others, well, they're using the earth for their own nefarious purposes, says Kit Yarrow, a consumer psychologist at Golden Gate University in San Francisco.
I'm calling it the dark green movement that is just blatantly hostile. The point is not really protecting the environment. The point is an opportunity to be able to feel superior to somebody else and to kind of get off on releasing a little bit of anger.
Then there are those in between, like Rita Dalton, the hotel employee, neither ruthlessly dogmatic nor acting out her frustrations in the name of the cause.
I can hear the eyes rolling when I walk away sometimes, but I'm just a frustrated worker trying to keep the recycling bins clean and empty, and not really a Nazi.
In Boston, this is Beth Titel for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today to go with some housing statistics that were out this morning. First, the numbers. Sales of existing homes rose last month more than anybody thought they would. The bad news is that the number of homes still sitting on the market unsold hit a 40-year high. That gets us to this item we found in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution today. The local trade association there is telling home builders that it's okay if they need to talk to somebody about their problems. The Greater Atlanta Home Builders Association says it's a trying time in their line of work, and there's nothing wrong with seeking professional help. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 241 points, about 2%. The Nasdaq shed 49 points, 2%. The S&P 500 dropped 25 points, almost 2% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time, driving's not for dummies, you know.
In one study, they found that driving at 30 miles an hour, you were exposed to 1,300 pieces of information per minute.
Makes you think twice about using your cell phone now, doesn't it? I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.